David Tan, what are the top 2 to 3 things you look for in an LLM?
For me, it's all about transparency and explainability, knowing what went into the model, how it's trained, how it's made, and how it generates outputs.
Couldn't agree more, David. All that and more on Transformers. What does transformation mean, and what can we learn from those leading the way? I'm Anne Fanai, CIO and Vice President of Business Platform Transformation at IBM. Join me as I talk to my fellow nerds about tech, transformation, AI, and, you know, maybe even a little about just being human. All that and more on Transformers, an IBM Think podcast. So, David Tan, thanks so much for joining me today. You are CTO of CrushBank. So what does your CTO role entail, as we're learning over the course of this podcast? Means different things at different places sometimes.
Yep, absolutely. So thanks, Anne. Thanks so much for having me. So at CrushBank, being CTO essentially means I'm responsible for everything from design and architecture to direction of our platform. So what's great is that means I get to play around with all the new technology, look at new things that are coming out, try and keep up with what's happening in the industry, which is especially difficult these days. But it's just a great opportunity for me to really try to make an impact in my clients' businesses, and then again, just in the what's happening with AI in general.
So you bring up your working with your clients and the role you have inside as well. So how do you approach transformation both with internal to CrushBank as the CTO, and is there a different approach you take with clients perhaps?
So, I mean, it's pretty much the same sort of approach and idea. We try to do the things that we do with our clients internally as well. Whether it's, the old adage of drinking your own champagne, or more so, I like to just understand the technology, understand the business problems we're solving. Really, it doesn't matter what type of business, what sort of industry you're in. We all face a lot of similar challenges. So if I can tackle those internally with what we're doing, I know that gives me and my team the confidence to go out to the market and really be able to brag about the things we're doing and just sell ourselves that much better.
Pivoting off of that as well, you're a huge AI nerd, and obviously I mean nerd in the best possible way, and we will get to in a little bit of a little set up some of our shared background and how we grew up professionally. But how do you pick the right model? There's so much. It's, we're probably at near a top of a hype cycle right now. What are the things you think about when, choosing an AI, choosing an LLM, choosing the components to drive a good strategy or architecture?
So it's kind of funny. We were pretty early to the game in AI, right? We've been doing this since about 2015, before anyone knew what generative AI or large language models were. I mean, that was the technology sort of underpinning the things we were doing, but it wasn't the way it was discussed. And then, we had that watershed moment late in 2022, and all of a sudden, everybody's worried about the latest and greatest LLMs, right? How many parameters it has, how big the context window, the benchmarks, the feeds and speeds. Fortunately, since we were here before that, we never got dragged down into that sort of conversation or that decision making. So for us, it's always been more about finding an iterative process and a way to figure out what solves the problem best for you. So for example, in our platform, if you kind of look at it end to end, we have 4 or 5 different models that we're using. Now, some of them are just different versions of the same model. Some of them are a transformer or a mixture of experts or just any other sort of versions of different models. But for us, it's really about being able to evaluate them intelligently and deliberately, right? So we'll step through a process where we want to evaluate for literally the day before we're recording this, Llama 4 dropped, right? So my team's already playing it with it in the IBM Prompt Studio, testing it in some of our sandboxes and seeing, okay, it does this better than something else, or it does this worse, or maybe we should evaluate it this way. So, we've never gotten caught up, like I said, in chasing the latest and greatest model. I think of it the same way I think I have thought of throughout my career of evaluating any technology. How does it work in production? How does it add to the solution? How does it help what you're doing? And then there's, of course, the cost and performance implications of it. So really, I think that's a mistake a lot of people make, is not thinking about it the same way we've always thought about making technology decisions.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, because it's, so much of what we do in the technology space, there, it's like the old basics still hold, like build versus buy, like what, like just real simple basics. So I love the way that you're anchoring that as in it's a new thing we're evaluating, but it doesn't mean the process or the behavior or the approach with which we do technology assessments, et cetera, changes. That's great. So I also understand, do you have an opinion on large model, small model? That's one of the big debates that's coming out now. Obviously, my seat at IBM, we have a small model point of view, but curious, because you're not just working with, IBM's models, you're working with the whole range, as you mentioned, Llama, et cetera, yesterday. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I have a pretty strong opinion, but frankly, I have strong opinions about almost everything.
Oh, no, that's why you're here. We want your strong opinions.
So listen, the way I look at it is the smaller model that does the job, the better, right? So most people, again, think that I need to find something that's got the most parameters, the largest training base, all of that. I think that small models are significantly more powerful when you use them the right way. So that means doing things like tuning and training the model, tweaking the context window, just sort of evaluating how it works. So I think the small model anchored in enterprise data used the right way is far more powerful than you can do with anything that's got 3 trillion parameters. Like, who cares? Like, what are those 3 trillion parameters, right? At this point.
And who can, like, who knows, like, it's almost like technical debt you're building up by too many parameters, right?
You don't know what's causing the output you're getting. And at this point, the model is being trained on the output that they create. So that's sort of self-defeating, right? So yeah, I'm a big believer in the smallest model that gets the job done. And like I said, in our process, that's always how we do it. We go from small to large. And listen, there are times, we'll try the Granted, 8 billion parameter model, that won't work. So we'll step up to the 20 billion. And if that does a great job, maybe we'll try another one, but we'll generally fall back to the last smallest one that works the best. And the other thing that's great about it is that it really helps me optimize cost and performance, like I said, right? Most people that I see sort of getting their hands around this stuff don't understand the cost implications of what they're doing. And then equally the performance, right? So if you're, as these models get bigger, they're just not going to get they're not going to perform better, right? If at worst, they're going to perform the same. I think the smaller models really aid that.
Tying those two points together, like how you assess technology, I mean, cost performance, it still is a continuing underpinning as we go through the, where AI is going to go. Like, again, if we don't take a prognosticator view, but a present state view, right?
And right.
So, but let me pull on the thread a little bit more, large versus small. What about customized models versus really the more open models? What are your thoughts there? Does that play into your decision making?
It does. I mean, when possible, we try to work with open models, open source models. I mean, I'm all about transparency and I'm about understanding, what data makes up the inputs, and how, again, like I said, these answers and these inferences are created. That being said, that's not a one-size-fits-all solution, right? There are clients we deal with that are in very specific, very specialized industries that have their own language, that have their own data, their own key skills or key training. And there are times when you need to train models for them, or there are times when a closed model is better for them. But again, I fear the unknown of that, right? Whether it's, what we still don't know about how it's going to come down around like copyright and legal implications to unpredictability. So, I heavily encourage people that I talk to really focus on the transparency around open source models and transparent models that you can see what went into the training of it.
You're pulling all those pieces together. Are you seeing a repeating set of challenges as people are, going through similar decision-making process? So is there, a typical pitfall in the AI transformations that you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned earlier, we're in a bit of a hype cycle. And what happens in the hype cycle is people often get disillusioned. It's really easy to work with, I'm not picking on them, but we'll use an open AI, for example, right? It's really easy to just get an API key and start using that model. And it actually works fairly well when you first start using it. It's not until months in when you start to realize that you don't control the outputs and you don't control the training and you don't really know how these answers are being generated that people start to get disillusioned. And it always comes back to the same thing. Well, AI doesn't work or AI is not ready yet. And it's like anything else, right? If I give you an IDE and I give you Python code and you start writing something, sure, it's not ready if you don't know what you're doing. But if you don't know how to, if you don't know how to work with AI or how to work with these language models, and again, understand what the inputs mean, what the training mean, what the outputs mean, and then you talk about governance on top of all that. If you don't understand all of that, then absolutely it's not ready. But it's not that the technology is not ready. It's quite frankly that you're not ready for it.
The hardest part of any transformation, we've hit on this multiple times through this podcast and even conversations I'm sure you're having, it's humanity, the humanness of it, the people. And it, again, not good or bad, it's just it's the nature of being a human being. And are you seeing people start to balance the positive impact versus the uncertainty a little bit more? Like, what is it? Are they starting to understand more what the real impact is to their work, to how they work every day a little bit more as we get a little more mature every few hours, right? It almost seems like.
Yeah, exactly. Every day. I think people are starting to like rein in and understand the possibilities and the opportunities, right? People no longer, I shouldn't say nobody, but most people no longer think it's magic. They also don't think that you can replace, you know, 100 people in your organization, but they do realize that you can make people more efficient and you can scale better. And I think, and this is a point I've always tried to make, it's not AI replacing people, it's people using AI replacing people that don't use AI. Super simple example. I won't let when these sort of models came out, I wouldn't let my development team use AI for writing any code. I wasn't confident in it. I wasn't sure that they were going to evaluate it, that they were going to run it through the same processes and checks. Now we've gotten comfortable. We have a process around it. And if they want to use AI for code generation, I'm actually okay with it if it's done the right way. And I think that's the point that people are starting to settle in, right? Like, you can't fire your entire marketing staff and just ask ChatGPT to write you a marketing plan, but you can
imagine. Oh my. We would get some really...
Well, it would be fun.
It would be entertaining to a point.
But you can make your marketing team significantly better, right? You can make your sales force better. And I think that's the sort of reality that people are settling into. And along with that, I think comes the fear dying down of, you know, machines becoming sentient and taking over the world. Now, of course, every couple of months, someone says that they are this much closer to AGI, which we know is probably not true, but we'll probably get there eventually. So certainly those fears will rise back up again. But I think, again, people are starting to realize, and you know, quite frankly, it's the hype, the media, and the industry around it that just, you know, oversell the kind of things you can do with this. Hopefully we're on the other side of that. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, no. And by the way, any answer that loops in the Skynet possibility, I'm here for it every day.
We can do that all day. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Okay.
No, but I mean, I can see it, right? You know, there was, I think it was... just recently, we had the robots is what they're bringing out on stage everywhere. And it's like, it is a little bit of a, you know, if you understand it versus if you don't understand it. I absolutely see how this could be... an uncertain moment, right?
You know, honestly, what probably happens for people like you and me, like I remember when Boston Dynamics initially released those robot dogs, you know, 15 years ago.
They were so cool.
Yeah. They were, and they were lifelike. And then I saw the Black Mirror episode where the world was taken over by these things. But I often underestimate that most people don't realize that. So this is kind of their first exposure to things like that. So they haven't been eased into it. So now they think overnight, like someone woke up one morning and built a team of robots that can do your job. Now, that being said, in 10 years from now, and it's funny, you know, with what we're going through now, just from an international trade situation, 10 years from now, every factory in the world will just be robots putting machines together if they're not already. But that's, again, that's us easing into it. I think most people don't realize that we've sort of, this stuff's been around for a while. It's just getting better.
One of the things when we were chatting last week or so, like we kind of came from a shared started background. Like I started my career like, you know, in a data center, you're like crawling under the floors, cabling things, you know, running, you know, big iron, you know, then you're kind of thrown in like, okay, you end up desk side with someone helping them. Or I wrote some little Lotus Notes databases for customers back in the day. It's like kind of that, you and I kind of had that shared, like really nitty gritty hands-on IT perspective. But I think we both, like your title's CTO right now, mine's CIO. And titles are titles, but I think to me, the way we both grew up almost kind of shows there's really a shared, there's a shared world here. Like you can't be a CIO without, you know, I think an effective CIO without really kind of understanding maybe the engineering world, the hands-on world. And I think stronger engineering leaders understand that, hey, it's not just, you know, we're far past the days of, well, I just turn on something, it plugs and chugs and we configured it and data's flowing, right? The world is much more complex. And I'd be curious your take on CIO versus CTO roles and how they evolve as well.
Yeah, so I think I probably always went towards the CTO side instead of CIO because CIOs have to deal with too much on the business side, right? You got to report to the CFO, you got to explain, you got to be plugged into applications and data. For me, as much as I love that stuff, I was always more of a hands-on technologist. Like you said, same as you, right? My business partner and I started our first company right out of college, and it was an outsourced IT company. It became a managed services company, but I always like to joke and tell people that, you know, we made our bones early on by ripping out Novell NetWare and putting in this upstart little operating system called Windows NT, right? Back in the days when Microsoft gave their software away for free. I'll never forget the first time I had to deal with a Novell network. I made my business partner crawl around the library, around the server room rather, and find the orange covered book so I could figure out the commands for NetWare. So I've always been the ones that said, let me roll up my sleeves and get my hands dirty. And yeah, absolutely. I think that's what kind of gets me to this point now where I'm more interested in evaluating the technology for the technology than not the hype related to it. I think that sort of background of IT support and, you know, building servers and setting up networks and supporting users, like if it doesn't break you, it, you know, it makes you into a pretty solid CIO or CTO, you know, because it's a tough chasm to cross, right? Like end user support is no fun. I always used to joke that we never get calls because someone said, hey, I had a presentation today and it went perfectly. Or that email I printed out, you know, the printer worked, it worked. Every support ticket, every request, every problem, you know, starts from negative and goes down from there. So I guess what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right? That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, I report to the COO essentially of IBM. And I was having this conversation with her the other day. I was like, you know, it's those million things that go right. And that one that, well, that was a little slow, that it'll spin you out and spin your day. And I think I do like the way you bifurcated there with kind of the business problems. And I think, and that's one of the really fun ways CIOs and CTOs do work together though, right? At the end of the day, a CTO might be a customer to the CIO or vice versa, or if we're, you know, drinking our own champagne, as you put it. So I think it's that great shared knowledge, shared understanding. And, you know, thank you for a little bit of the Novell PTSD with the mention of the orange yep. books. And I you brought up NT. One of my fun stories was my first tech lead job was in 1999, I think it was. I was the technical lead to convert the corporate campus of the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company from token ring to Ethernet. And we had to spend nights going desktop to desktop because it was Windows 3.1 and Windows NT and, you know, manually configuring batch, you know, the batch files. And it's like,
yep.
Yeah. So it's like you kind of have these like the moments.
Been there. Yep. The most fun I think I ever had doing something like that was when one client just said, I don't need that stuff. Just cut it. So I was able to literally take like a huge pair of shears and just cut all the wire, stuff it in the wall and just run Ethernet cable.
Oh, yeah. No, that's like I have great joy in just turning things off, cutting things. It's like pleasures in life. Small pleasures in life.
No doubt.
You said something interesting to me also last week that you really resisted the title of a CTO. And I know we just kind of went down the rabbit hole about titles, but like, I think it's fascinating why you resisted it though.
So, I mean, you wouldn't know to look at me, but for the longest time, I felt like I didn't want to give myself any title like that because I felt like I was the youngest guy in the room. So it's kind of, it's funny. We started the business, like I said, right out of college. And I know we're similar in age. So the times that we were graduating college, like this stuff was relatively new, right? People didn't have personal computers. Most companies didn't have networks, right? So there was nothing wrong with being the young person in the IT space, especially with personal or small, medium-sized business technology. But inevitably, you ran into the 60-year veteran whose entire job it was to watch the backup drives, right, and the backup tapes. And they always treated you horribly. So I like to joke that I feel like I went from being the young guy in the room to the old guy in the room overnight. But, you know, I never really wanted to take on that title because I just didn't know, like, what does that mean? Am I responsible for all the technology? Does that mean, because we always used to joke again, anything that plugs in, they call us about, right? I don't want to be responsible for the phone system. I don't want to be responsible for the smart devices on the network, right? So as CTO, that stuff all rolls up to you, essentially. And as everything became interconnected, the world changed pretty dramatically. Ultimately, though, I had to realize that I was not the young guy in the room anymore, and I was able to wear the title a little bit more efficiently.
Yeah, no, and I one of my running jokes is the more the bigger the job I've got, the more business my hairdresser gets. Really, is what it happens, at least in my part of the world. So,
well, for me, my haircuts are shorter, so I mean they take less time. There's less. So.
And mine are longer. Like, I just fix this. It's going really gray. So knowing that your career started too, like you started your own company, and so you've also had to navigate this world where you've had to spend, you know, really begin to hone in the skill of communicating to the non-technical audience. And do you have tips? What are your tips? What have you really learned along the way about how do you effectively communicate complex technical issues to a non-technical audience?
So I like to think it's something I actually do really well. And I think the skills sort of developed naturally as I, you know, had to deal with these things, whether it was, you know, podcasts or presentations or webinars or, you know, large events and seminars. And I like to think that the key really is to just drop all of the technical jargon, right? Even if the crowd understands it, they're not going to want to hear it. They're not going to want to talk about it. So figuring out a more intelligent way to have that conversation in regular business speak, right? Like, what challenges does this solve for me? What problems can I overcome? I think I have that backwards. But what challenges can I overcome? What problems can I solve with this technology? How does it impact my day-to-day? So, you know, it's kind of developed organically, but I think my biggest tip would be, again, don't ever try to prove you're smarter than everyone in the room. I think that's the biggest mistake you make, right? If you get up there, for me, if I get up on stage at an event and I start talking, the last thing, if I try to prove I'm the smartest person in the room, everyone's going to say this guy's not that smart. But if I start talking to them in their terms about things that they understand, then, you know, I'll do a lot of prep, right? Like if I'm at an event that I'm talking to people in, I don't know, the insurance agency, I'll make sure I can talk about something in terms of how their industry deals with it. I could talk about their job titles. I could talk about their roles and responsibilities. So, you know, it's a combination of a little bit of homework, a little bit of practice. But again, the biggest tip I would say is don't pretend or don't think you're smarter than everyone else in the room. Even if you know you are, that's great to have that confidence to a degree, but don't let that come across when you're speaking because it will not relate well to the crowd.
Yeah, no, and completely coincidental, I think the saying I use pretty often is anyone who walks in the room asserting that they are the smartest person automatically is the dumbest person in the room.
And by the way, and I know a couple of guys from my team are watching this and they are crying, laughing to themselves because they think I'm probably the most arrogant, smartest person, or they think I think I'm the smartest person in the company. And while I may think that, I try never to have that come across. So.
Oh, no, that's hilarious. It is funny too, because I think one of the sayings, like there's two sayings my team is used to be saying is one, assume positive intent. You know, everyone's, you know, trying to do the right thing. The other thing is, you know, when we're stuck in a conundrum and, you know, you'll realize we're kind of at an impasse and, you know, I'm okay making the decision and leadership is, I'll sit and I kind of take a pause and go, hard on my sleeve, team, where are we stuck? And I think it kind of, it's that moment where we can recognize like, okay, we're kind of at each other's throats or we're finding a hard problem. It's like, it's that kind of reset of like, how do you get to the right outcome together? How are we, did we pick the most valuable outcome?
And I think that's another key piece of it for me. And that sort of comes from, again, starting my own business. For a while, it was just me and my business partner for the first 5 years. And we always used to say there's nothing that we would ever ask anyone else to do that we wouldn't do ourselves. So just being humble and knowing that everyone is a key part of the team, I think is really important. And it just sort of relates into everything you do.
And I appreciate sharing the humility, the humanity. And if I may ask you kind of to wrap up here, somewhat cliche question, you've seen an evolution. You're still really hands-on. You got the C title, but you're still super hands-on. Like, is there one thing right now in this present moment you wish you could wave a magic wand and have happen in the professional space you exist in?
I mean, the biggest thing right now is if I could wave a magic wand, it would be to let people understand that especially around AI, it's not about the magic in the AI, it's about the magic in your data, right? So if people only understood that every AI solution you want to build, however you want to leverage AI, whatever you want to do, comes down to the data you have in your organization, that's the single biggest message I try to get across in everything I do. It's a bit of an uphill battle. It's getting better, right? You know, people are starting to understand that a little bit, and there's technology that's evolving. But I'd say that would be the single biggest thing that I would, you know, educate people on to understand what we do better.
So well said. So well said. And David Tan, thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Anne. This was great.
Thanks to all of you for joining us today. We hope you'll come back every other Wednesday and hear some inspiring stories on Transformers.